So leveraging people that were good at the asset management side was one key component. And then the development was getting so big, even finding people that helped in the entitlement process and partners that helped parlay us through on big projects in the entitlement process really made a big difference on pushing projects through quicker, more efficiently, allowing us to scale a lot quicker. Those are some key components.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Jerome Maldonado is a highly successful real estate investor, business owner, coach, and speaker. And over the span of his 20-year career, he's done over $200 million in in-house transactions with another $52 million in 2021 alone, which I think we were talking off air, Jerome. That number might even sound a little bit light. You guys are rocking and rolling. I'm looking forward to jumping in today. So, Jerome, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Sam. Really appreciate you having me be here this morning.
Pleasure's mine. There's three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show. Can you very quickly tell us, maybe like in a 90-second version, where did you start? Where are you now? How did you get there?
I started in sales, direct sales and network marketing in the early 90s, 1993, in fact. And I'll tell you, that's probably the pinnacle to my success, learning sales, communication, business, relationships. And the company was put out of business in 1997 by the FTC. When we were, in a nutshell, we were left struggling, trying to figure things out. I landed up in construction on accident. I went back to finish up my college degree at a time when I felt like I had failed, and spent about a year in college. And at that time, helped my brother-in-law get his contractor's license. And I got my own at the same time. And I knew how to market and sell, landed up pouring concrete. We still own that company today. A year later, I realized that there's a lot of money in building houses. And I bought a piece of land. I built a house in 1999. And that's turned into subdivisions that we develop now, and a lot of retail that we did in pre-recession, a lot of office, a lot of warehouse development. And now we're doing a lot of multifamily development. And in fact, we finished off the year with about a little over $70 million on our books for 2021. So we're really proud of this year. That's the biggest year we've ever had with projects on our books since we've started.
And I heard that 2022 is looking like you're going to crest the $100 million number as well.
Yeah, it does. You know, we got one project alone that's just shy of $60 million that we're doing up in Port Orchard, Washington. So we're working on entitlements on that right now. So we're excited. We're excited for 2022.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's so much here that we could unpack. And I don't even necessarily know where I want to take this. But I mean, you guys are in multifamily, you're in affordable housing, but you're doing this all for yourself. Like, you're not building for other people. You're building it for your own company.
We're doing a lot of this stuff in-house. I mean, obviously, we're subbing out to a lot of contractors that we're doing a cost plus model with in other states. And there's partnerships involved in this. So when I say I'm doing it all for ourselves in-house, for our company, it is all in-house for our company. And obviously, you know, you can't scale without good people. And so one of the big things that I started in 2016 that really didn't parlay until 2018 was partnerships, good partnerships. So everything that we did up to 2018, we did 100% independently, just utilizing institutional money. And since 2018, we've been leveraging relationships. And so we've been able to scale to this, Sam, because of the relationships and the great partnerships that we've been able to put together with quality people.
What were some of the things that those relationships brought to the table that maybe were key ingredients for you?
There's certain things that you're good at, Sam. There's certain things that I'm good at. There's certain things that I dislike they're not my desirable areas to focus on. And so when people realize that there's people that do things better than themselves and they leverage those assets of other people, it really helps to scale a good business. And, you know, the asset management part of the business was never something that I had specialized in. We had built and developed, and we had managed our own properties, but it wasn't something that we really cared for or liked. And to the magnitude of asset management on a large apartment scale, we had never really done before 2016. My first takedown was in 2017 in that regard. And I realized that that wasn't a side of the business that I really enjoyed as much. I was really good at the development side, the construction, the value add side, the project management. So leveraging people that were good at the asset management side was one key component. And then the development was getting so big, even finding people that helped in the entitlement process and partners that helped parlay us through on big projects in the entitlement process really made a big difference on pushing projects through quicker, more efficiently, allowing us to scale a lot quicker. Those are some key components.
The entitlement process is one of those things that it's almost a business in itself. And if you don't know the levers to pull and you don't know the town or the, you know, city council meetings to go to and you don't know the right, it can be overwhelming and you're out there just trying to build something. So I think that's amazing. When you guys are doing these development projects, what's your end goal with them? Are you guys holding them long term? Are you leasing them up and then selling them off? What's that look like?
No, we're stabilizing them and keeping them. We do a cash out refi, pulling out some equity. Is this stage in the game, Sam, as I push closer to my 50s, I sit back and it's now real important for me, more for asset holdings. So we do, we buy them and we build them, we develop them, we buy the land, we develop them, build them, stabilize them, keep them. And then we'll do a cash out refi on a lot of them, take out that capital and deploy it. So we've got some little tricks that we do with that capital that that really make what we do financially viable, tax-wise, cash-wise, liquidity-wise, all of the above.
I'm assuming you raise capital, you know, for these opportunities. And do you keep those investors in, or is it one of those things where you cash investors out and then they move on to the next project? How does that work for you?
Some of them we do raise capital. Some of them we don't. Like I have a project here locally that I've owned land since 2006. We have no investors in it. We'll have some institutional money in there, obviously, but it'll be a $28 million project this next year. And so, but we've owned the land for a long time. And now our larger stuff, like the stuff we're doing in Washington State, stuff we're doing in Phoenix, the stuff we're doing down in Palm Springs, California, all have investors. We do minimize the capital raise on our stuff. You know, we'll raise a couple million dollars here and there. Port Orchard, we'll end up raising probably about 6 million, give or take. It's a bigger project though. When we do so, we do raise capital to leverage the investors out. Once we have stabilized the property, we go in and do a cash out refi, take current market value for it, do an appraisal, and then cash them out. There'll usually be two of us that'll stay in there, the main partners, and the rest of everybody else, they'll move on to another project.
Right, right. That makes a heck of a lot of sense. And this, I find this intriguing. You said you minimize your capital raise. Doing these large projects, how do you minimize the amount of capital you raise on, again, such big projects?
Couple things. One, we've been in the game for a long time. So we do have some cash in pocket ourselves, right? So we do bring cash to the table. And then we refinance our cash out at the end of the project, just like everybody else. So our skin's in the game, just like everybody else. That's one way. Second way is we never buy the land up front. What we do is I control the land. We go in and I put an offer on the land, we put in deposit money, we control the land, but we don't buy the land. If we can't control the land without purchasing it for a good duration of time, and if we are required to buy the land, we're requiring the sellers to do either an owner finance deal with like a 2-3 year call with either 0% interest or a very low interest rate so that we don't have as much liability as we're going through the entitlement process. Because the entitlement process, for those of you guys that don't know, it's all the engineering, it's all the zone changing, it's all of the subdividing, if there's any, it's all of dealing with flood control, arborists, all of the pre-construction before you come out of the ground logistics to get that project viable where they say, here's your permits, you can go, you know? And so that's the entitlement process. It's a time killer for a lot of deals. You know, it takes a year to 2 years to get a project out of the dirt. And so when we're doing it, I'm having that liability of $1 million piece of land or multi-million dollar piece of land tied up with cash out on it is always a liability. When we went through the 2008 recession, we used to do that. We'd buy land first. That's why I got stuck with the land that I'm developing now. And it's because we owned it. We stopped buying land in 2009. We just control the interest in the land. And we work through our entitlement process. And then when we're done with entitlement, Sam, the land is worth more. So we're able to do a larger valuation on the property and on the land, being that we have a viable project. So it decreases our capital raise because now the land is more financially viable. And so in that regards, we're able to go to the bank, leverage a little bit more institutional money, a little less capital from investors. Those little tricks are how we minimize our capital raise.
So let's go back to that 2008, because that was going to be one of my questions was, you know, if you've been in this since 1999, you've seen a couple of hard times, the dot-com bust, you've seen the 2008 crisis. What were some things, how did you weather the 2008? And then I guess, what are you predicting moving forward and how are you guys protecting yourself on the downside risk?
So we've lived through a lot of ups and downs. And 2008 was a very interesting time. We had office and retail under development, and we also had subdivisions. Our subdivisions saved our lives. We sat on them for a little bit. We were in an asset class just over the median. And I always tell people, don't invest in the median. Like right now, median homes are $350,000. The first people that go into bankruptcy are those who are getting purchasing homes with DNC credit. They're the ones that $200, $500 a month variables, that affects their life, right? Those are the people going into foreclosure first. So we don't focus in that sector. The sector that's just over $1 million in most markets, those are people that should probably be in $700,000 homes, $650,000 homes. And they're the people competing with the Joneses. Those are the other people that are over leveraged. Those homes over $1 million, not the ultra wealthy. We're not talking about people in the $4 million, $8 million, $10 million homes, just pushing over that $1 million range. That market gets hit second. So our homes have always been just over the median. People like our parents, the people like our grandparents, the people that have worked, have retirement, have more stable income, the professionals, that the doctors, the professionals, the people that are stable, haven't over leveraged themselves. Those are the people that hold a little bit stronger. So what I found out in the 2008 recession is that my homes were selling. They were just selling slow. And even at the worst time in the world, when I was originally making a little over $100,000 per build, I was still making over $50,000 per build. So we restructured our business model and we cleaned some stuff up. We got our builds up to about an $80,000 profitability. We shaved off some of the excess expenses on our builds. We cleaned up our business model. We cut our costs with our subcontractors. They were agreeant to it. And we were able to continue buying land and building houses. It really saved us through the recession. And then I started buying more real estate. The debt I was servicing on bad real estate, retail, and office, which almost took us under, Sam. I'm not going to sit here and pound my chest that I got through this like a breeze, because it took every bit of 3 to 5 years to really clean this up. I went to Phoenix, started buying single family homes for $20,000, $30,000, fourplexes for $40,000, put a conglomerate of fourplexes together that added up to 62 units. And it was a bunch of garbage real estate, a bunch of D-class real estate in a subpar area, and it cash flowed. And we took that real estate and we 1031 exchanged that stuff in 2016 and we killed it. I think all that real estate that we paid under just right around $1 million for is now worth probably close to $15 million. Just at the time, it didn't seem like we were going to hit a home run with that stuff. But I'll tell you that stuff was such an asset. All that garbage D-class real estate became a real asset to us now in later years. But we had to weather the storm to get through it for sure.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think there's a lot of lessons learned there. One is the ability to pivot and stay afloat. You went to a new city, you started buying real estate there. You know, you were losing money maybe in some other sectors, but you had one that's holding things up. And it's just that ability to kind of reinvent. Do you find it's easier when you're forced with that situation to go back and rebuild or to pivot, you know, the more times you do it? What's kind of the key there?
Nobody wants to have to. I guess our experience has become very broad because of the need to pivot over the years. And our ability to pivot has allowed us to stay afloat. My dad is a super conservative, and he always would tell me, Jerome, why do you spread yourself so thin? Why don't you just focus on one thing? And when the recession hit, my dad was my accountant. My dad was a CPA for 32 years. And my dad did all my accounting up until just about 5 years ago. And when the recession hit, he sat down and he goes, God, Jerome, it was a really good thing you were diversified. So contrary to a lot of people's beliefs, you know, we were hyper-focused and immersed in the real estate construction world, but we were diverse within that sector. Mm. And so we had a lot of diversification, and it really saved our tail at a time where we could have easily went under. I think we skid by on a dime. You know, we really did.
How are you guys protecting yourself, you know, from any future correction? Or I guess let's ask that. And then the second follow-up question to that is what do you see coming down the pike?
I'm really conservative. You know, you hear the numbers and you sit back and go, okay, how does somebody who has millions of dollars of projects on the book at the height of an inflated market sit back and say that they're conservative? I'm conservative, Sam. You know, I've studied this. I take things in pieces. The amount of new builds that we take on are conservative enough that if we were halted and the market compressed by even 30%, we'd be profitable. Some of the houses that we're building now are in the $700,000 range. We'll make about $170,000 per house. And with that, if the market compresses, I'm okay, Sam, if I make $50,000 and I have to give up $100,000 because still making a profit, right? And so I look at it like that. I go, what's my worst case scenario? And I look at the worst correction in time, and that was 2008 financially, you know, the worst percentage wise. And at a 30% correction, we're going to make some money, just going to make less of it. And with our apartment builds, there's a mass housing need right now. People need to realize it's going to take close to a decade just for us to fulfill it, if we can fulfill it. And right now, we're actually continuing to move backwards on that need because of what's happening at the ports, not being able to get materials, inflation, just a lot of building factors that are slowing down the process, where there's a lot of builders and people out there going, we're on board, we're building. but they can't press as quick as they want to because we're bottlenecked with materials and getting the needed materials, labor, all that stuff is affecting us. So we have about a decade to be able to fulfill this need for housing. And instead of going after Class A with all the amenities, Sam, the swimming pools, the gyms, all the croquet deals, all the clubhouses and all the amenities that most of these establishments have, I said, I'm not going to go after that because those guys are charging $2,500 to $3,000 for rents. When the market compresses, the way I feel is that those people can go to Planet Fitness and go get a $25 a month membership, and they can come into my establishments, which are new construction, small garden style, not a lot of amenities, not a landscaping, but a nice new modern build, you know, and we cut out the elevators, three-story construction, no swimming pools. If we do put a gym, it's very small, just like a little hotel gym in a small office, but real simple builds. And we're able to lease those for $1,600 to $1,800 a month, substantially less than a lot of this other Class A stuff, compete with a Class B market and Class B rents and go in there. And I just feel like we're sitting at a perfect sector of real estate where if the market does compress, people are going to come into we're going to gain tenants as opposed to losing them.
Right. I love that. I love that. Jerome, thanks for taking the time to pull back the curtains on your company, how you guys have grown, some of the ways that you guys have weathered tough times. I've really enjoyed today's conversation. Let's jump here into the final four questions. What is one digital tool or resource you find you can't live without?
My phone. I can't live without this thing. I do all my business from this. I very rarely jump on my computer anymore unless I'm here doing a podcast. Other than that, I do almost 100% of my business right off this telephone.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. If you could help our listeners avoid just one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
Don't get greedy. There's a pie. And in that pie, there's different slices, just like a pizza. And take your piece of the pie, give up the rest of the pie in good partnership. I wish I would have done this years ago. I limited my growth in early years and I wish I wouldn't have. I was always selfishly cutting out middlemen, leaving myself with good partnerships. And it really bottlenecked my business. I'll tell you, good partnerships and good relationships are key in scaling. And just finding those relationships are really important. I encourage people to not jump into partnerships, but find good relationships, people you trust and like that have proven themselves over the test of time and partner with good people. It will help you scale your business.
I love it. That's great. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
We're creating affordable housing and we're helping people do the exact same thing. So we created an educational program in 2018. We have people that are coming from all walks of life, painters and cabinet guys. And we got people, I got a physician that just got started with us. And we got people from all sectors of life that are coming in, making six figures, buying land, building houses. And we're relieving the world of the rooftops that they're in need of. And we're bringing more people to the market to learn how to do it. And I had a mentor, Sam, years ago. He said, Jerome, if you can find a massive problem and not only see the problem, but find a solution to it, you'll mass a fortune. And so we're not only doing that, we're bringing people to the game and they're massing fortunes. And so there's nothing better than making money, Sam, except for one thing, and that's helping other people do it. So when you take people that couldn't do it without your influence, it's the greatest feeling in the world.
I love it. I love it. Jerome, if our listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more about you, what's the best way to do that?
I'm real easy to find. My name is in the podcast notes and in the chat there. And so if you guys just Google Jerome Maldonado and you go to Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, or Google, any of the platforms, and just type in Jerome Maldonado, you can DM me or my team. You hit or do a direct message out to us or just Google it and his up on our website. We're real easy to find, Sam.
Jerome, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Sam, thank you. Really appreciate you having me on the show.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.